This is East End Inc. Today we present author and former New York City medical examiner Barbara Butcher talking with novelist A.M. Holmes about Butcher's memoir, What the Dead Know, learning about life as a New York City death investigator. They were recorded at Canyus Books in Sag Harbor in August 2023.
Hey, Barbara, you got a hanging man in the 3-4 precinct. You want me to call you a driver? Charlene's voice was low, as if all this death business was a dirty secret. Sure, Charlie, send me your best. Just give me 5 minutes to slap on some lipstick. She laughed as if I were going out husband hunting instead of looking at dead people. Putting down the phone, I got that familiar little thrill I got when there was a decent case to investigate. Something other than the natural death of an old man with heart disease found in a locked apartment. I like to figure things out, to find clues and solve puzzles, to locate the cause behind the effect. Fortunately, that was my job. And I loved every minute of it. I picked up my tour bag full of equipment and went out front to meet my driver. Most OCME drivers were called by their first names, Rick or Nathan or the occasional Maureen. But Everett Wells was a dignified older gentleman we called Mr. Wells. It was a mark of respect, even if it was at odds with his other nickname, Shake and Bake. He earned that one for his habit of alternately stomping on the brakes and accelerator while blasting the heat. He may not have been the greatest driver among the 15 or so at OCME, but he was my favorite. Mr. Wells was protective of me, insisting on accompanying me into buildings, while other drivers preferred to nap in the car. I was always glad when we worked a shift together. He grabbed the tour bag from my hand. "You know I can't let a lady carry a heavy bag," he said. "It don't look right." "Thank you, Mr. Wells. Does Mrs. Wells know you're out with me tonight?" "Mrs. Wells knows everything. You want Kentucky Fried after we do this?" It was either that or McDonald's, as we could never sit down for a decent meal without my radio going off for another case. We got the address on the call sheet, a rundown tenement in Washington Heights, sandwiched between a bodega numbers drop and a family-owned funeral parlor. There was no elevator, so we tromped up the stairs through the layers of smells that permeate many old New York buildings. Boiled cabbage on the first floor, pine sol over God knows what on the second. Then we reach the third floor. Once you know the smell of death, you can pick it out in a flower shop. Strangely sweet with a bitter undertone, like strawberry milkshakes made with garlic. After a few weeks on the job, I could walk any block in New York and point out a building where someone was decomposing.
Before we even go further, what is in that kit? What is in the bag that he's carrying? What are your tools? These are some of the secrets that aren't quite spelled out.
Gloves, of course, because it's, you know, it's a nasty business.
Latex, leather, vinyl, what are we talking?
Talking your basic latex, okay. But heavy duty, because you're reaching into some strange areas. You know, little envelopes for evidence tape, and a camera. I mean, everything's got to be recorded, every single thing at that scene, from the entrance to the exit, and then, you know, you close in on the body.
Are you wearing a Tyvek outfit the way they do on British TV?
You know, originally in 1992, we didn't. I mean, we were using Polaroids in 92. Mm-hmm. And we were
like Andy Warhol.
Very much like Warhol. We were handwriting reports. DNA was not big, so it didn't matter if we shed a few hairs.
Right, sure.
Of course, later on, yes, I was in a little polar bear suit, you know, all Tyvek'd up and indistinguishable from every other investigator in the room. But basically, just junk, just stuff for poking around. Oh, and of course, a thermometer and condoms.
For the thermometer.
For the thermometer, yes. Yes, because one of the ways you determine time of death is by the body temperature. You lose about a degree and a half Fahrenheit in the average room every hour. So there's little calculations you can do, but of course, this requires me to grab the person, flip them over, pull down the pants, and then I would take out a condom. And the police officer would look at me, "What the hell are you doing?"
I know you've written a little bit, but I'm hoping you'll talk a little bit about the difficulty of, it is an intense job, obviously, and how did it affect you in you know?
Very, very badly.
Yeah.
You know, when I first started the job, I was in training, and I had just recently gotten sober a year before. So I was a little shaky. And one of the first autopsies I saw was on an 8-year-old girl who had been raped, smothered, and thrown in a junk heap in the Bronx. And just seeing that, it's very difficult to describe the emotions that ran through me. Horror, terror, dismay, a disbelief that this is the human condition, that this can happen. I could barely speak. And then I asked the pathologist, I said, how do you live with this job? How do you go home every day after seeing this and live a life? She said, Barbara, you've got to surround yourself with things of beauty. When you live here, you must enjoy art, music, dance, food, love, and you must create things to counterbalance the death, despair, and destruction that we live with here every day. And did I take that advice? No.
This is East End Inc. We're listening to Barbara Butcher talking with novelist A.M. Holmes about Butcher's memoir, What the Dead Know, learning about life as a New York City death investigator.
There was one of those examples, actually, that occurred in a strange setting. Was it in, like, not a, like an elevator shaft or in an outdoor, like in a space that was cramped and difficult to get to?
All of them.
Yeah.
You know, there's no such thing as an open, airy death scene.
Right.
That's pretty rare.
Right. Where you just come upon a person in a field.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I think I probably had, well, yes, I did have one swamp case that was very open, but it was freezing cold. And no, for the most part in New York, people die in their little cramped apartments. Although I did have that one fabulous apartment I went to. An elderly woman died a natural death, but I had to go because her physician was out on the golf course and couldn't attend to her or sign a death certificate. And her son let me in, a very nice-looking gentleman. And it was one of these super elegant Fifth Avenue apartments where the elevator
stops
opens
at the
in,
apartment.
Yeah, in the foyer. Yeah.
Right.
Is that the right word? Foyer.
Yes. And they spell it differently too. Right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
And when I went up to see the lady, she had a round bedroom, huge. And hanging on the walls were impressionist masterpieces. You know, small works, but still, I mean, there was Degas and Cezanne. There were either Manet or Monet. I can never tell
exactly
which one. But absolutely astounding artwork. And there she was. It propped up in a little satin bed jacket and a Freta sheets, which I learned a lot about from rich people, about nice things.
Linens, right?
Yes, linens. And after I did the examination, you know, I explained to her son that everything was a natural death, and he said, thank you for coming, and he noticed that I was distracted. I kept peeking at the walls. He said, would you like to see Mom's art collection? I said, no, I couldn't do that. I don't want to trouble you. He said, no, she would like that. And he took me around to each piece, and it was astounding. This is stuff, museum quality, that she had collected over the years, and I got to see the splendor of this work. And I silently thanked her as I left, and then immediately went down to the Lower East Side to a squat where I crawled beneath the building into a pile of trash to find this poor drug addict who had overdosed. And I had to literally crawl through the garbage.
Oh, wow.
But that was my day. I didn't take the advice. I just worked hard and hard and hard until I started to fall apart.
Yeah.
There came a time when my relationships were a mess, and I would come home and just take off my clothes and put the sheets over my head, trying desperately to unsee what I had seen that day, to unfeel it. And then I, by fortuitous just fortuitous event, someone said, you should buy a little house in the Catskills. They're dirt cheap. The towns are abandoned. And I did. I got a cute little place with a stream and grass and flowers and trees, and I fixed it up. And I got a dog and two cats. And that brought me to life. That eased the pain that I felt every single day for these folks. Until, of course, 9/11. And then I got destroyed again. But one of the things I did was I learned to detach myself from my emotions in order to do the job, because I was there to get justice for these folks, for the victims. I was there to get answers for the families. I was there to do a service. And if I let my emotions run me, I couldn't have done the work. So I shut down, did the work, and I think I did it well. The only problem is, I discovered, you can't switch off one emotion.
Right.
They all switch off.
Right.
And so I became cold, uncommunicative. I was a mess. I'd come home and my partner would say, hey, what do you think about a vacation? I'm like, God, Jesus, leave me alone.
Right.
What do you mean vacation? Do you know what just happened today? Police brought both suspects to 520 First Avenue, home of the OCME. Of course, many of those brought in for exemplars were innocent, but detectives told me the details of this arrest. These two were good for it, Barbara. Kobo rolled over on his lover so fast that his lawyer had to slap him so as he'd stop talking. Tony Lee Simpson was brought in first. A handsome young man with dark curly hair, he had a lean, wolfish face that showed off the outline of his jaw. He wasn't giving anything away. But something about his body language, defiance or detachment, I wasn't sure, told me that a cautious approach was in order. I introduced myself and explained what needed to be done, basically, essentially draw blood and pull hair from his head. Simpson was silent as I prepared the syringe and paperwork. His feral eyes never left my face. He sat back in his chair and let me do all the talking. Whatever the reason, he gave me his consent. He never spoke a word. My heart pounded as I went about my job. I felt the taste of cold metal in my mouth, like galvanized iron. Having seen in living color what this man could do to a human being, I wanted to run. It was a primal reaction, and I needed to override it. All the while, he was silent and still. Kobo, on the other hand, never shut up. Oh, hello, my dear. What is all this now? What are you going to do to me? George Kobo was much older than Tony, old enough to be his father, in fact, short and stocky with a little pot belly, who was balding and wore glasses. If I saw Kobo on the street, I might have thought he owned a store, one of those places over in Lexington that sold collectibles and antiques, things from estate sales. I can imagine him hunched over a glass case, pulling out a porcelain figurine, the perfect gift for an elderly aunt. I could also imagine him hunched over a body. I offered Kobo the same introduction I had given his partner, and by his response, you might have thought we were at a cocktail party. When I told him I needed to pull 30 hairs from his balding head, he gave a playful little shriek. Heavens, no! I've lost so much already, and I can't spare a single one. Must you take so many? I almost laughed, but caught myself. He was charming, I'll give him that, but he was also a vicious psychopath, a cold-blooded killer. Remembering the chief's advice, I decided to let him win a little to ensure his cooperation. I'm sorry, Mr. Kobo, but we do need 30. If you want, I can pull them evenly from around your head so your hair won't look patchy. Why, thank you, young lady. Please, call me George. I was having an amiable conversation with a serial killer. What an interesting job this was.
And you write a little bit about this, but I'm curious about where this lands for you. There's always the space between what we know fact-wise and what we know instinctively in our bodies and our brains, and like how the neighbor's like, yeah, don't go trick-or-treating there.
Yeah.
Like, there are just things that we know about the world we live in and about people, and I think in the work that you're doing, there is that other sense of depth of knowing or human capacity for all kinds of things. Does that resonate with when you were working on cases? You would be like, I think there's something else happening here.
There's a sixth sense. I think that, you know, whenever I walked into a scene, well, first of all, if the police called and said, Barbara, you got a homicide in the 2-4 precinct, I'd say, no, it's not a homicide until I say it's a homicide. Because if you walk in with that predetermined notion, that's what you're going to look for. Mm. And that's not the right way to do it. To truly investigate, you walk in blank and open and let the scene, let the body tell you the story. The dead people will tell you what, you know, dead men don't tell tales. You just got to listen. So I took my hands off my ears, put them over my mouth, and listened to what the room was telling me. But here's the scary thing. Like when I met Tony Lee Simpson, this vulpine. When I met him, I got a cold metallic taste in my mouth. Every alarm in my body was ringing. But when I met George Cobo, his partner, I liked the guy. And then there's a chapter on, there was a serial killer named Aaron Key who killed young girls in East Harlem. And again, no attention was paid to these 11 little girls because they were girls of color. They weren't rich. They, you know, it's, a white girl dies on Park Avenue is all over the papers, right? The New York Times is everywhere. But when people of color die, it's another story.
And in the gay community and in the trans community, a huge gulf of like...
Right. Yeah. It's, you know, there's a hierarchy of, I guess, human life, but not to me, not to you.
Right.
And not to anybody here, I'm sure, but hey, the world is a little different. Anyway, when I met Aaron Key, I knew his crimes, and I had seen some of the most brutal, awful things that he had done, and yet... He gave me that look when I met him of like the Princess Diana look, like head down, looking up with innocence, a guileless, charming sweetness.
So interesting and creepy, right?
And he was charming. He was handsome. And he scared the living hell out of me. I had to pull, now back nowadays for DNA, you do a cheek swab, it's no big deal. Back then we took blood, head hair, and pubic hair in the case of rapes.
Right.
So I told him I needed 30 pubic hairs, and I was so frightened to even say that, and he stood up and said, I understand, ma'am, do what you have to do. I thought, oh, what a nice boy. The cognitive dissonance of what he had done versus how he was presenting at that moment. And that's why I say that my book is not about death. It's about life. It's about people and the things I've seen people do. And it's, you know, I'm scared. I'm scared a lot. A lot of PTSD in there.
It's funny. I was going to ask you about PTSD. And I was going to ask you about both your own PTSD and then... As someone who's lived this life for a long time, how do you talk to younger people or, you know, and departments about how to sort of try to protect their workers and, you know, all of that?
You know, it's only just beginning. Over the past 2 years, the recognition that first responders, cops, firemen, EMTs, and last responders like me, we get badly emotionally affected. We get soul crushed, we get damaged by this work. And in the past, I remember saying to my boss, you know, Chief, a lot of the guys are drinking and having affairs, gambling. I mean, we're falling apart out there. He said, Barbara, no, we're strong people. We're brave people. We do the work that no one else can do, and it's noble, fine work. We don't need that. Okay, that was the only time I ever saw him be wrong. Completely and utterly wrong. Just recently, they've started, and it happened with the Las Vegas, that mass shooting from that hotel.
Yes.
My friends there were so devastated by seeing 57 young people slaughtered in the street that they started therapy. They started talking to one another, peer-to-peer counseling. at the New York City Medical Examiner's office now, they actually have therapy dogs. Mm-hmm. Once a week, they bring in dogs for the investigators and the pathologists to pet. How wonderful is that? And they say, you know, look, everybody go out for coffee, go out for a drink. Let's talk about the cases of the week. Back in my day, we never spoke except to brag. Hey, you should see the one. I just did a triple over on Lexington. What a bitch that was. And because it was a guy's world. And it was a guy's world at the office. And, of course, with NYPD, that was a man's world. But I fit in there.
Yeah.
I fit in real good.
I'm sure, but I also think it would be so much fun because it is really kind of swaggery and cool and bravado. You know, they're, I mean, at great cost, but it's, I mean, the personalities involved are amazing and wild.
Very wild.
They're not, I mean, NYPD are not, I mean, they are wild men in the best of ways and worst of ways, right?
Yeah, and I love cops. I come from a cop family, and I was so excited to work with them. And I remember the first time I walked into a scene, and the cop at the door said, "Yeah, honey, how can I help you?" I said, "Well, I'm from the medical examiner's office, so I just want to look at the body." "Yeah, don't worry about it. Crime scene's already taken care of it. You're okay." "No, I have to." And then I said, "This is bull." The second case I went into, the next time a cop said to me, "Yeah, honey, how can I help you?" I said, "You know what? You can't help me, but I can help you. I'm from the medical examiner's office. I'm going to go in there. I'm going to examine that body. I'm going to tell you what he died from, how he died, what time he died, and maybe even who did it. And then you can go to court and say, Barbara Butcher taught me." And it worked.
We heard New York City medical examiner Barbara Butcher talking with novelist A.M. Holmes about Butcher's memoir, What the Dead Know, learning about life as a New York City death investigator. The book was published in June 2023 by Simon & Schuster. The complete talk is online at moreeastendinc.blogspot.com. Some upcoming readings at Canio's Books, Sag Harbor, include on Friday, August the 25th at 6 p.m., Star-Crossed, a true World War II Romeo and Juliet love story in Hitler's Paris, with Heather June McAdam and Simon Worrell. On Tuesday, August 29th at 5:30 p.m., writer Brian Cluley Johnson presents his new historical novel, Everything Goes, set in Shanghai in 1935 through 1945. Today's East End Inc. was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Marianne Callendrell and Catherine Zocher of Canio's Books. This is Hazel Kahn.